You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women.
We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results. I'm Lyndon S.
And I'm Susie Thorpe, and we produce and present Women Making Waves. In this edition of Women Making Waves, we meet Cassandra Farran, who has written a book about losing her mother to dementia. This powerful but positive story from Women Making Waves contributor Bobby Jones is a fascinating listen.
We hear from Louise Rowland talking about her debut novel, The Girl's Book of Priesthood, that offers a real insight into the challenges facing young female priests today, meticulously researched with a touch of humour, revealing a young woman behind the collar. Louise Rowland speaks to Susie Thorpe.
Hilary Cox Condren is a community artist and engagement worker. Dave Doggett, ex-chairman of Cambridge United, described her as community glue, a vibrant force of nature. Hilary has been involved in lots of community projects. She speaks to Linda Ness about her life.
That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves.
Linda, have you been touched by dementia? I certainly have. I think it's touched most people now, dementia, hasn't it?
Yes. Sadly, my mother had dementia. I can really relate to the story that Cassandra Farran is about to talk about to Bobby Jones. She talks about how she wrote a book about it, actually, called I Lost My Mum. It's quite a moving story.
There's no cure for dementia. But it's great that Cassandra Farran is talking about it. And that's the key, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is. It really is. So let's listen to Women Making Waves contributor Bobby Jones as she talks to author Cassandra Farran.
She now gets to live in her world. That's the way that I see it. She no longer could fit into our world. But in the care home, she's allowed to live life again on her terms.
I'm talking with Cassandra Farran, and she's an unusual author in that she tends to write from the heart. Now, you might think, doesn't every author write from the heart? Well, they do, and then they don't. It depends on what type of book they're trying to write.
I know, Cassandra, that you like to mentor people to write their own books. And sometimes they have a book within them, but they don't know quite how to put it onto paper. Is that what your kind of soul writing is all about?
Yes, absolutely. So I love helping people to share their stories because I believe that that helps to give their life meaning. So a lot of people know that they've got a powerful story, but they have these doubts and these fears of who would want to read my book? Am I good enough to be an author? Do I need a degree to write a book? And they have all these fears that they're not worthy of becoming a published author. And I'm living proof that it doesn't matter what your qualifications are, what your job is, that if you have got that passion to share your story, then you can.
So how did you get into writing?
Well, I was at a crossroads in my life about 6 years ago, and I had a mentoring session with a coach, and she advised me to write down everything that happened in my life and that everything would become apparent. Now, at this point, I wasn't sure what she was talking about. I had ended my marriage 6 months prior to this conversation. I was a single parent with two children to two different fathers. We had had to start our life again. I didn't own my own business at this point. So to be honest, I wondered why writing this down was going to help me. But I did my homework and I realized that when I wrote down my story, I could connect everything that happened in my past and it helped me to make sense of everything. And a very long story short, but 3 months later, I set up my first business. I continued to write my journey and my story, and 2 years later, I published my first book.
And you managed to get it published, because just getting a book published is not a simple walk in the park.
Well, I chose to independently publish my book, so I didn't need to ask permission from anybody. I believe that Everyone has a choice. You can look for a traditional publisher or you can independently publish your book. Personally, I love to write my books on my terms, which is why I like to independently publish.
Your latest book is called I've Lost My Mum, and this is obviously part of your later story of your life. Tell me, why did you lose your mum?
So my mum was diagnosed with dementia in 2014, and initially this wasn't a massive change to my life or my mum's life. It was quite gradual. But what we realised is that this wasn't just about becoming a bit more forgetful or repeating herself a bit more. It was a massive change to not just my life, but my dad's life, my mum's social life. She lost all of her independence. She wasn't able to go out on her own. It was a massive snowball effect that then caused my mum to not know who her family was, who her friends were, and she now lives in permanent care. So in that sense, I have lost my mum.
2014, that's really only 5 years ago. And that journey between 2014 and now must have been a very bumpy road for everybody.
So yeah, I'd say bumpy journey is a very good way to describe it. She knew when she'd stopped teaching, so she was a teacher for all of her life. And when she retired from teaching, she knew that something wasn't right, but she kept reassuring herself and to us that she was just more relaxed because she'd always worked very hard as a teacher. She'd always worked very long hours. And she just said, well, my brain's a lot more relaxed now. So, you know, it's just getting old. She was in complete denial that anything was wrong and never admitted to herself or to us that there was a problem, even when she had a formal diagnosis.
Even though she'd had the diagnosis, she still didn't believe it. How did you begin to realise that there was something wrong?
So my mum would repeat herself a lot. Like, say, within the space of an hour, she might tell you the same story 12 times. And she would repeat the same childhood stories. I call them childhood stories because she'd tell you about stories from her childhood. She lived abroad for a while and she'd have these favourite stories that she would feel comfortable repeating. So she would tell you a lot about that. And if you tried to speak to her about something that was in the current moment, it became more and more apparent that my mum couldn't keep up with the conversation. She couldn't join in with the conversation. In social situations, she would become quite withdrawn and quite overwhelmed. We'd have to watch her if she needed to leave a restaurant to use the bathroom, for instance. We'd have to make sure that she got to the bathroom and that when she came out of the bathroom that she could see where the table was. She became very attached to my dad in the sense that she wouldn't want to go anywhere unless my dad was going to be there. It was like my dad became her safety blanket. And this very vibrant, positive, outgoing and independent woman began to fade away into someone that seemed a lot older than her years. It was like living with a child again.
How did that make you feel as her daughter?
It was very sad to watch because, as I said, you know, my mum was always such an outgoing woman. This is a woman that went bodyboarding for her 65th birthday. If I took her to soft play with my children, she would be the first one down that astroglide and she would be the first one into the ball pool. We've had so much fun and my mum has always been such a young at heart woman. To see her fading away into someone that we didn't recognise was tragic, really tragic.
And that all started with a lot of repetition. Now you've got to the stage where Dad really couldn't cope with her anymore because it becomes a very big burden to look after someone who cannot let you go. I can imagine that for your dad that was very difficult and he would have had to have done some personal hygiene and things for Mum. Unless you managed to get help?
She didn't get to the point that she needed any physical help before she went into the care home. It was more that she couldn't be left on her own.
Was there help out there for Dad and for you?
When my mum was diagnosed, we received a letter from the doctors, a leaflet and a prescription with some medication that was going to help, hopefully, just to calm her anxiety and possibly slow down some symptoms, but nobody can give you any guarantee. There is no cure for dementia. And then we had a nurse that would check up on my mum just to measure her blood pressure and to check any side effects from the medication, and that was it. As time went on, when we reached crisis point, when my mum went missing, when my dad was finding it very difficult to cope, we did phone a dementia helpline, and they were very helpful. But due to the demand on the helpline, sometimes you can't get through immediately, somebody needs to phone you back. And my dad couldn't speak to the helpline if my mum was in his company, which she always was. I took charge of any phone calls, and I did phone the helpline, and they're very helpful, very reassuring, but they're not there at 3 a.m. when my dad was at crisis point. They're not there when you're crying your eyes out, wondering, you know, how you're going to tell your children that something has happened to their nan. Yes, the helpline has helped, but we've had to cope a lot on our own.
I can't believe that, well, it happened to you, that the doctor just gave you the diagnosis and a leaflet. I just sort of said, well, there you are, get on with it. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I agree. But at the time, you don't know to question these things. So that was our normality. And we were aware that there are memory cafes that are open in the area. So they are a gathering of people that either have dementia or care for someone that have dementia. Once a month, you can go along and have a cup of tea and a chat for a couple of hours. But my mum wouldn't go anywhere new. Even though she didn't have capacity, she's a very clever woman, and she knew that something wasn't right deep down. And she would say, like, don't you dare leave me with a babysitter. Don't you dare get me any carers. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm perfectly capable of coping on my own. So even getting my mum out of the door was a massive step in itself. So to get her to a new environment where she might suspect that people thought that there might be something wrong with her, it just wasn't an option.
No, I can see that. And also, given the way that your mum's dementia was progressing, if somebody came into the house to sit with her so that your dad could go out and have an hour or 2 hours on his own, that wasn't going to be an option.
We tried that. So again, when my dad needed some more freedom to just do the things like going out to get a paper or doing the food shopping, going to the dentist, we tried to get what's known as companionship carers. So it's like a professional friend. And even though we had a plan that I would go to the house, introduce the companion as my friend and say that my friend had moved into the area and she just wanted to have a chat with my mum or go for a walk around the park, my mum knew, and she would say to my dad afterwards, is that lady writing a report on me? And in the end, it got to the point where they had quite a big argument. And my mum said, I do not need a babysitter. And she got so angry and distressed that we decided we couldn't carry on. It was too distressing for my mum and too distressing for my dad.
And when it actually came to the point that you took her to a care home and left her there, how did you feel about that?
It was one of the hardest days of my life. Collecting your mum from a house that she's lived in for 30 years, she's been married to my dad for 40 years, you know, knowing that she would not be returning to that house was, there is no words actually for that feeling. But at the same time, when I left the care home, I expected to be consumed by guilt. I expected to feel this overwhelming sadness. But that is when I actually felt relieved. I knew that my mum was safe then, that was all that mattered.
You were actually relieved. I can understand that because it's been such a responsibility all that time. How has she settled in?
So it's been a year now, and I can hand on heart say that the hardest decision of our lives was the best decision of our lives. The care that my mum has received has been outstanding. She now gets to live in her world. That's the way that I see it. She no longer could fit into our world. But in the care home, she's allowed to live life again on her terms. If she doesn't want to go to sleep at night, she doesn't have to. There's 24-hour care there. She's safe. She's looked after. And she's at peace.
Yeah, so it was a very good decision. A very difficult decision, but a very good decision. There must be very many families out there who are facing the same kind of thing as you had to face. What would you say to them when their heart is telling them to do one thing, but their head is telling them to do something else?
It's incredibly difficult, but I would say that your loved one that has dementia, you have to put their safety before your emotions. And that's easier said than done. That's the way that I coped with that decision of making sure that no matter what happened, my mum was safe.
You wrote a book about this. Did that help?
Yes, is the answer that I can tell you now. But I can tell you when I was writing the book, there were times when I thought, why am I doing this? Because it did bring up so many emotions. I write, like as you said at the start, I do write from my heart, which means that I have to go back into that emotion of what I've been through. I had to relive everything. But in hindsight, I know that this book is part of my healing journey to acknowledge what we've been through, acknowledge the emotions that we've been through, but also to see how far we've come as a family and that the outcome was, it was the right one for my mum.
What have you learned through all of this? How do you feel about this? Alzheimer is a wicked disease. You can't see it. You can't grab hold of it. You can't, as you said, they can't really give you any treatment for it.
I've learned on a bigger scale, a bigger picture, you've got to live in the moment. So as an individual, like take every single day that you've got and just enjoy being in the present moment. And whether that's on your own, living your own life, or whether that's being with someone that's got dementia, be in the moment with them. Yes, it is devastating. Yes, it is heartbreaking, but enjoy those little moments when you might be laughing together or spending some time at your favourite garden centre. You've just got to enjoy those little moments.
So there are times when mum does seem to be like the old mum.
Yeah, something that I found with my mum that really ignites her is music. And when I was driving my mum to the care home, I instinctively played her favourite song, which is Dancing Queen. And there was a reason for this in that I actually was scared that my mum would be asking me questions of where we were going. So I just turned this music up, turned up Dancing Queen, and we just sang the top of our voices, Dancing Queen, all the way until we arrived into the car park. I've since noticed that if I play that song to her, she knows every single word. She will get up, she will dance with me, and she will smile, she will laugh. It brings back the old mum. So play their favourite song, enjoy those moments of joy.
Thank you so much. It's been really, really interesting. And we would encourage everyone to get hold of that book, particularly those people who are experiencing what you've been through.
That was Cassandra Farren talking to our contributor, Bobby Jones.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Fancy being called the community glue. That's what Dave Doggett, ex-chairman of Cambridge United, has called our next guest, Hilary Cox Condren.
And I think with very good reason. If you look at our website, hilarycoxcondron.co.uk, that's all one word, you'll see the number of projects that she's been involved in. Really astounding and very, very interesting projects, many of which I'd heard of, actually.
Really impressed with that website.
Indeed. So I thought it was a good idea to get her into the studio and find out a little bit more about her.
Now we're now going to hear from Hilary Cox Condren talking to Linda Ness.
Anybody who's passionate about what they're doing or a cause that they're involved in gets excited, and you can veer off in lots of different directions, which is a brilliant thing because that's how new ideas spark.
Hilary Cox Condron is an artist, educator, activist and designer described by Dave Doggett, the ex-chairman of Cambridge United Football Club, as community glue. Hilary uses art to motivate and empower people and galvanise the communities that they live in. Hilary, tell us a little bit about yourself. Were you into art as a child?
Yes, I've always been into art, yes. And in fact, I have very few memories of primary school. I have two memories of primary school. The first, in my first week there, doing a drawing. And then as I was leaving school, one of my primary school teachers telling me that I would be an artist.
You then left school and you spent some time in South Africa. Was that the next move or was
no,
there something in between?
That was quite a bit later. So I left school at 16. I quite a typical school, I guess, for that period, you know, of the late 70s, was told not to bother taking my O-levels. Like
really?
Lots of children, you know, sort of quite demotivated in that period by schools, told, you know, that I was a waste of space. Somehow went on to art college from there when I was 16, and that's how I ended up in Cambridge. moved on to Mill Road, did the illustration course at CCAT, and I've stayed. I've been one of those students that stayed.
I think a lot of people do, don't they, actually? A lot of people come here to study and just stay. But I get the feeling that you really love Cambridge.
Yeah, I really love Cambridge.
Yeah.
I love it, and I love that I can give Cambridge to my children as well.
Yes. And tell us about your stint in South Africa, because that was a bit of a life changer for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big life changer. So I went to Johannesburg and my plan was to do some travelling. I just formed this really close bond with a young boy called Johannes who was, I guess, around 9 years old. And I actually met him in my first week there. I was going to go travelling and I stayed because I was enjoying it so much. So I stayed for a year. And Johannes and his friends used to come and join in with me when I was, you know, I was painting murals and shop fronts. And I used to take a big bowl of rice down to the market and we'd all share it out and make beads and then we'd go and sell beads on the market. And I was just having fun and I was having a lot of fun with Johannes and his friends. And I didn't think about the impact that it was having at all. That wasn't sort of part of my train of thought at all. And one day we're all sitting on a curb drinking some lemonade. I must have been sitting a little bit further away from them. And a man came up and started shouting abuse, which was, that was nothing unusual. You know, I was getting death threats for hanging out with them. So it wasn't unusual for any of us to get abuse. They got a lot of abuse. And he was basically saying that they were good for nothing, blah, 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 shouting at them. And one of the little boys opened up his hand and he had one of the beads that we'd made earlier that day. And he opened up his hand and he said, "I'm not good for nothing. I made this," and showed him what he'd made. And I was like, God, that's what we're doing.
And something clicked at that point, presumably.
Yeah, it did. It's like, that's what we're doing. This is huge, actually. It's huge. Before then, I was working as a designer and an illustrator. And it changed everything about how I thought about art and participation and just the power of art and creating together. And so that's what I decided that I wanted to do, you know, when I came back, and that is what I did.
You do a lot of things, and your website is great because it's jam-packed with projects that you've been involved with.
Yeah, well, you're right. I'm sort of all over the place doing lots of things. It's fantastic, really, that I have so many opportunities now. My passion is about connecting people. It's about social change and social justice and equality through the arts, the power of the arts, getting people involved, giving people a voice and being able to initiate action through that, whether it's through the conversations that we have in making something or the sort of the change that you can go through whilst you're making something together, or the change that you can initiate through people viewing the outcome. So, yeah, I work with a lot of different groups, from coordinating projects for city council with young people in schools to Jimmies and homelessness to, I do a lot of work with Extinction Rebellion. I do a lot of work at Kettle's Yard. I collaborate with a lot of different people and a lot of different projects.
And that's what your website indicates, because it's jam-packed, full of information and full of things that you've worked on and really interesting projects.
Thank
as well.
You very much. And I still always think, oh, I must update my website.
So well, there's more.
There's more, yeah. There's always more.
And how do these projects come about? How are they initiated?
Well, it's a mix, really. Sometimes I'll see an opportunity and apply for it. Sometimes I'll work in collaboration with an organisation or charity to develop a project. Well, actually, I'm very often involved in developing it, but whether I approach somebody or whether they approach me, we'll apply for funding very often. And that's really sort of planted and it grows from there, often in collaboration with other artists and other cultural venues as well. I'm really passionate about collaborating, you know, because I like to learn. It's good to share.
It's good to work with people as well.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? It's always a new dynamic when you work with different people.
Absolutely. And there are so many amazing artists in Cambridge and so many people involved in activism and new initiatives, you know, and so the more that we can strengthen the sort of web across Cambridge so that we can work together and really collaborate, you know, the stronger we're going to get and the we'll be and the greater outcomes that we'll have.
And when you start a project, do you have an idea of what the outcome is going to be? Ever.
Ever. I'm sure I must have had at one point. Yes and no. I'll write a project. There will be a lot of scope for changes along the way. And projects are very led by participants as well. But, I mean, that sort of depends on who I'm working with, because sometimes there is an outcome, but then we'll find a creative way to produce that, yeah.
It's really interesting when I'm hearing you saying, I write a project, because when you think of artists, you kind of never think of them as doing almost business plans. But I guess if you're going for funding, that's almost what you're doing.
I know. Well, of course, you've got to think about... When I talk about a project, it's not just the artistic outcome that I want it to have. I want to inspire action, really, and to inspire critical thinking and bring people together. So I'm not working in a void, you know. So then I'm going to have to think about how to reach people and then think about how to facilitate the project, really, and enable people to be able to feel comfortable to build that project. You know, so really, I'm a facilitator in many ways, that's sharing skills and facilitating.
And I guess in writing that down, it's actually a really useful thing to do.
For heaven's sake, I've just started getting
in your own mind.
Yeah, I've just started getting excited about logic models. I can't believe it. Oh, yes, I've got a logic model for that. But you're right, especially if you want an outcome, because anybody who's passionate about what they're doing or a cause that they're involved in gets excited, and you can veer off in lots of different directions, which is a brilliant thing, because that's how new ideas spark. But if you know what your outcome is, or what you want to achieve, you know, what action do you want to achieve, then you can keep relating back to that to make sure that you're doing that, really.
Which project, do you think, out of the many that you've done, had the biggest impact?
The Activate project that I've been coordinating for Cambridge City Council and My Cambridge. So that's a collaborative project with all the museums in Cambridge and the Junction, NA Theatre, Menagerie Theatre. And we're working with young people at Coleridge, Community College. So quite a small cohort there that maybe don't have access to the arts and culture, don't feel as confident and engaging in it, and don't really get into town. So it's about connecting people to the town and learning new skills. But one of the things that I've been able to do through that project, and indeed one of the points of the project, was to be able to track the changes for those pupils. It's just embedding arts into their lives like that and giving them a sense of place about Cambridge has just really changed, supported every aspect of their lives. And so seeing that and seeing that grow is, well, it's fantastic. It's a beautiful process to be a part of. It's had a lot of impact. And then being able to share that impact means that these projects can grow as well, you know, that other people can look at the evidence that we've created and be able to use that to do other projects. I coordinate the Arts Working Group for Extinction Rebellion. I mean, that's not a job, you know, that's my activism work and campaign work.
But you're very passionate about that, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. And there are so many fantastic artivists in Cambridge that are
artivists
involved. Yeah, so
I
activist
heard that
artists
term. That's great. Artivists.
Might be a bit made up. We
no,
create.
I like that.
So been very involved in that, and banner making and flag making, and we have some creative projects coming up as well to keep raising awareness, keep finding creative ways. And for a campaign like Extinction Rebellion, it's really important to have that visual creative side to it. You know, it kind of works in lots of ways. It works to spread the message, to get people involved, to get people talking about it, but it's also very restorative for ourselves to work together, and that's also like a really important element of it.
You've worked with different media as well, I noticed, from your website. There's been film and sounds and art, of course, and I think theatre as well. Mm-hmm. Which is your favourite? Have you got a favourite medium to work with?
I think my favourite is whatever I'm doing at the time. Although, I think when you're creating something, like you say, whether it's a bit of typography or a huge installation or an animation or a bit of physical theatre, when it comes together, it's the best feeling in the world. It's perfect. Whatever it is, when it works, it kind of feels like, especially when you're working collaboratively, it's something that has a life of its own. And so whatever medium it is, when it comes together and you see it having that shape and having that life of its own develop, well, I mean, that's what keeps me alive, that bit.
I'm actually quite surprised you haven't done radio work, in fact. Have you ever considered that?
Oh.
You hadn't thought about it.
You're saying I'm talking a lot.
No, I just mean it's another way of expressing yourself and another way of getting messages
over.
Yeah,
you're right. And we were saying that a bit earlier, weren't we, about how actually we have a lot in common in finding different ways to connect to people and give out messages. Mm-hmm. And part of that for us both, I think, is a genuine interest, maybe nosiness, some might say.
Yes. interest in people.
Mm-hmm. And listening and getting excited and wanting to share that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. If you didn't do this job, mm-hmm. what else could you see yourself doing if you weren't an artist? I can't imagine you doing anything else, but what else do you think you'd be into?
That's a tricky question. I think maybe something outside, building something, getting grubby. I mean, I always wanted to be a dustman, actually.
A dustman? Really? It's a very good job. And I'm looking for drivers.
But it's not the same as when I used to really want to be one, where you had the big clanking bins and you could hang off the side of the truck and things. That was like, oh, I really want to be able to hang off the side of a truck. So that was what I wanted to do when I was at school, before I knew that artists could, you know, really work as an artist, I guess. I wanted to hang off a dust truck.
Well, we hope you don't become a dustman, because I think you're doing a very good job doing what you're doing at the moment. What's next then? Well, I know you've projects.
I've got lots
ongoing.
Of projects on the go. So, very excited to have just heard that I'm going to be working with a few community groups and with the Kite Foundation to build the punts that are going to be part of Cambridge Pride Carnival Parade. More Extinction Rebellion things. And I'm just going to interject there to say, if anybody would like to get involved in any way with Extinction Rebellion, Google them and go onto our Cambridge Extinction Rebellion website. And you'll be able to find the Arts Working Group on there as well if you'd like to join it. But there's lots of different working groups, lots of ways to join in, make a difference, have your voice heard, all those things. Activate will continue. I'm also doing quite a few workshops at Kettle's Yard at the moment, which is exciting. I'm going to be doing the Castle Hill Open Day for them. I'm going to be working with them. And I'm doing a few more Oscar Murillo-based workshops, which is really exciting. That's who's exhibiting there at the moment. I'm also working with Cambridge Curiosity and Imagination. We're in a field, in a sound tent in Histon this weekend, with some amazing noises, like we've got recordings of like ladybirds climbing up leaves and
it's almost science-like, actually, isn't it?
It's incredible. I haven't done those recordings. Somebody called William Searle has made those. But we're asking people to listen to them and then have creative responses to them and then explore the local environment, sort of making a fantastical map of Histon and Impington, which is good fun. I'm going to be artist-in-residence for the Mill Road Depot project, which is really exciting. So that's a new build that's on Mill Road. And my role there really is to find creative ways to involve the community, to celebrate Mill Road, to look at how to use the spaces that are going to be coming up there, you know, to be a creative and vibrant community. So my art practice is very much about identity and place building as well as art building. And that's really exciting. I'm going to be working with a few other artists and history works on there. I work hard though. I work a lot of hours.
You do, don't you?
Yeah, I work hard. It's sort of my life, really.
It's your passion, really,
by
the sound of it.
But I know that I'm lucky, yeah. I do a lot of projects that people can get involved in. And, you know, I'm always up for lots of collaboration as well. So, yeah, I'd love to hear from people. Come and join in.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today and telling us about, your life, really. your life through art here. It's been really, really interesting. Thank you very much, Hilary Cox-Condren.
Thank you.
And that was Hilary Cox-Condren, community artist and engagement worker, talking to Linda Ness.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
I wonder now how many girls are asked if they want to be a priest when they're older.
I can't imagine that's a question that many would be asked. Certainly it wasn't when I was at school. You were asked, really, if you wanted to be, you know, a secretary or a journalist or something like that.
But not a priest.
Doctor.
Well, it was really fascinating talking to Louise Rowland, and she's been talking about her debut novel, The Girls' Book of Priesthood, what it's like for a young woman to train to be a priest.
So let's listen to Louise Rowland talking to Susie Thorpe.
In all other spheres of life or professions, women are making great headway, and you think about the numbers, it might be 50-50 or even more than that. This is a very, very different world, and there are some parts of the Church of England where there's open hostility to women priests. So I was absolutely fascinated to dig into that story and get the human side.
Well, you're incredible, actually. You are a business writer, journalist, keynote speech writer to, well, leadership, blogs, business and general features and advertising copies, and working in-house for multinationals and small startup agencies as well. You've got a huge amount of experience, and most recently as a member of KPMG's digital marketing team, working for the Brexit team, let's put that one in too.
The B word, the yes.
But we must also just stress this fantastic book that you produced came out last year in May 2018. It's called The Girls' Book of Priesthood. I want to know why you want to write about priesthood for women in general.
I was very intrigued by the idea of writing about that because I knew a guy who was training to be a priest, a young curate, and I was keen to write a novel with the idea of actually somebody in that, doing that role, living with a family and as a sort of renting a room in a family, and how that dynamic would work, because people have lots of preconceived ideas of what priests or curates would be like. And I sort of started down that path and then thought, well, what about if he was a her? I wrote about a young female trainee priest. That opened up a whole world. I went out and interviewed. I was lucky enough to be able to interview about 15 or 20 young women training to be priests or who'd been in the job 2 or 3 years. I met some of the suffragettes who'd walked down Whitehall. I met people who were in small parishes, in city parishes, and it was such a fascinating picture. I thought this story actually is pretty unique. Nobody's really written this. I mean, there have been some, and usually for some reason thrillers, there's a lot of, or not thrillers, sort of detective stories. I have no idea why that's a genre, but apparently I hadn't, you know, I know it sounds extraordinary to say, but I'd never seen The Vicar of Dibley because we...
Had you not?
No, we lived overseas for a long time as a family, and we throughout all that time, that was on when we were overseas. So I didn't watch it. And once I decided to write the book, I decided not to watch it, because I didn't want to write it. I decided that I needed just to write the story that I wanted to write. I started this research and then it was just fascinating. And the people, the women I met were incredibly generous, because it's very private stuff, this, asking somebody when they felt that sense of calling, when they decided that this was something they wanted to do. It's the ultimate woman in a man's world. It's the ultimate old boys network or club, if you like. And that's not meant to be disrespectful, but only very recently that women have been able to be priests in the scheme of things. I think this year was the 25th anniversary of the first women ordained. In all other spheres of life or professions, women are making great headway. And you think about the numbers, it might be 50-50 or even more than that. This is a very, very different world. And there are some parts of the Church of England where there's open hostility to women priests. So I was absolutely fascinated to dig into that story and get the human side.
I'm pretty determined too. And as you say, you did a lot of research. This particular novel focuses on young women in priesthood as opposed to older generation, but your research took you from many generations of women in priesthood, and that is absolutely fascinating. Your bit here about 25 years celebrating women in priesthood in the UK, but other countries have been a little bit better on this, haven't they?
Yes, I think Australia was one of the first. I think Canada was earlier. Other places were. The Church of England is catching up. But I think in terms of the culture, I think the numbers of young women coming through. And so when you're a curate, it's basically like being on a graduate traineeship. That's the equivalent. And my character, the book is about her first year in the parish and it's her training year. It's all or nothing. If she doesn't make it to the end or she screws up somehow, then it's curtains. So that's why it's so important. But I think culturally the church is still very old fashioned. And in some ways, if you worked for a big multinational corporate or bank or a law firm, there'd be a big HR department into diversity and so on. I think the church is somewhat behind. I mean, people sometimes talk about the Church of England being 50 years behind the rest of society. I heard that quite a few times when I was interviewing people, and I think that's, we think about, you know, gay marriage and everything else. So what I was interested in when I was talking to these women, young and older, was how they felt about that, what drove them to do a job that most people would consider really, really difficult, because as well as the vicar side, or the, you know, the sort of religious side, the spiritual side, there's all the other stuff that goes with the job.
I was particularly interested in Margot. We can say Margot's the protagonist in your fantastic novel, but she had a friend who was quite outspoken and quite fashionable.
Yes.
And I loved that connection. I loved that relationship, but you are living in the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. I have two daughters in their early 20s. The girls, or the young women, rather, I was meeting are absolutely like them. So they like the music they like. They watch the Kardashians. You know, they like makeup. You know, one I met had these fabulous high heels that she wore. And, you know, why not? I mean, they're normal young women who happen also to have this side of their personality that means that they feel a calling to go into the church. And actually, I think that's an enormous gift for the church that you have people like that joining. Actually, everybody should be represented. I think they're very brave. And somebody did talk about them as insurgent, because you could work in fintech, or you could go off and be in the army or be a pilot, all of which are sort of could be pioneering things. This is equally pioneering, because actually you're going into an institution that's thousands of years old. As I said earlier, the two ends of the church, so the evangelical low end is generally pretty hostile to women, or not hostile to women obviously per se, but women at the altar, you know, standing there as the priest or the vicar. And then the other end is the high church end, the Anglo-Catholic end, which, as the name would suggest, is much closer to the sort of Catholic church. And of course there are no women priests in the Catholic church, and people feel extremely strongly about that, and you have to respect their views. That they're not intended to be sort of damaging or personal, but that's what people draw on the Bible for and say, well, this is what it says and that's what it says. And somewhere in the middle you have this sort of central space where young women are coming in and, you know, making headway.
I like the idea when anyone is training to become a priest, male or female, that everything hinges on the all-important relationship with your vicar, the incumbent, as you just said. And you say that the introductory pets and owners session at the Theological College, a form of clerical speed dating.
Yes.
I love that. I mean, my mind boggles.
Yeah, in fact, there is, here in Cambridge, there is a Theological College, and they were very helpful. I met a couple of people there and spoke to people, including some of the young women training. Yeah, I mean, imagine that in any other career. You know, you sit down and, because of course it's about personalities and chemistry, and you spend a huge amount of time with this person. I mean, we've just had Easter. In your average Church of England church, there might be three services that day, a dawn one, an 8 o'clock one, and a 10 o'clock one. You're going to be together. You're going to be preparing for it for all the previous weeks. And then during the week, you've got all the admin, the office stuff, you've got the pastoral things, you've got mending the hole in the roof or the floor or whatever it is, and you're working very, very closely together, and I would say more closely than most other jobs, certainly that I've had. I mean, you're kind of, it's 24/7 in some ways.
Louise, I know this is a very personal question here, but are you religious? Did it change your attitude, or did it enhance it, or did it bring you back somewhere that you didn't find you would be?
I come from a sort of background where we did go to church, and I do go to actually a similar sort of setup to the church in the book. I mean, I haven't written about the place that I go to, but for me it's a very private thing, and I didn't write the book to sort of proselytize in any way. I mean, I wasn't interested in that. I just think it was an interesting story. There is, I mean, a couple of people have jokingly said, oh, did you ever want to be a priest? And of course the answer to that is no. Did I? No, I think I came away from all my conversations with these very extraordinary women hugely impressed, very admiring of their guts, actually, because most of us work, you know, 9 to 5 or 6 to 7 or whatever it is that we work, and then we clock off and we go home and we have a different life. And it's much harder for people who are priests to do that, because the sort of lines, the porous line between your personal and your private life, people watch you and they have assumptions about you. But one of the things that I most enjoyed about the women I met was their sense of humour, because they all had it, and it's real gallows humour. And I'm sure you get it in the police force, I'm sure you get it in the army, I'm sure teachers have it, basically letting off steam by black humour, really, just laughing at stuff. And I think, you know, when things get hard, it's an escape valve for us all. I'm sure the cabinet currently dealing with Brexit, they probably, there's a bit of sort of banter going on there. Yeah, I was really impressed by that, and I thought that was something I really wanted to capture because it's a human side.
And when you were doing your research, were the women priests, were they quite surprised that you were going to write this book? Were they a little bit reticent about it?
No, they weren't reticent. I mean, somebody had basically opened his address book for me and given me their, asked if they'd speak to me, and they weren't. That was another thing. It's actually very humbling because you are asking people very private stuff about their sense of vocation to do the job, also their private lives and, you know, their relationships and their relationships with their families and so on. And I could have carried on doing that actually for a very long time. Someone said to me, you need to stop and start writing it now.
Did you find it was very shocking to hear of the stories about the clergy? Did you feel that, gosh, this really happens with women in clergy?
Yeah, it does. And I've heard actually since the book was published, I have had a couple of people talk to me about their own experiences of very difficult stuff that they've had in their parish, where not only the sort of casual verbal sexism, but actually more than that, sort of general harassment and so on. I think they're very brave because it would be much easier to go off and, you know, work in for a law firm or become a teacher, head teacher or whatever, than actually go into a world where a lot of people not only have preconceptions about what you should be, don't want you to be true to yourself, if you like. And obviously things like your personal life and so on. I mean, lots of people would have preconceptions about that. That's why the church is wrestling with the whole gay marriage issue. But I think in a corporate environment, you'd have an HR department that would be red hot on some of this stuff. And I think the support isn't yet there yet. That's my perception. I mean, you know, obviously I'm not in the church in that sense, but that is the sense I have. And I think 25 years of women being priests, and it's only in the last few years the numbers have really gone up exponentially, that possibly needs another 50 years before things are.
When you say about support, obviously from the outside in, that's you're coming from the outside in and you're actually researching and you're highlighting this. I want to ask you in a moment about the reactions to your book, because it's been a year since this book came out. But support within the church from men, has that been exceptional or is that quite slow in coming forward as well? Have you had, you say you've done research and you've been talking to lots of women, understandably, because it's their experiences, but have you spoken to any men in the clergy? Men, my gosh, those men.
I have spoken to a few. I think it's back to that relationship between the trainee and their vicar. Their incumbent, as they're called, their vicar. They're their boss, their manager for the year, and it actually, that's where the support is. I think you need more senior women role models. That's probably the answer. And I think the fact we now have Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, who's a former nurse, actually. She was very senior, and then she's now Bishop of London. That's a huge thing. And she's obviously in an extraordinary position to sort of promote the cause for women in the church. I mean, that's, you know, I think she's second or third most senior in the church. It's a very big deal that she's there.
So now we talk about the reactions, because it's all very well writing the book and researching the book and finding enlightenment. The reactions, have you had to have a hard skin yourself for this, or has it? I mean, the book is fantastic, don't get me wrong. Read it, it's beautifully written, and I take my hat off to you.
Thank you.
It's absolutely fantastic. But I'd like to know from you reactions, because it is a very, very reactionary subject, isn't it?
It's really interesting. It's absolutely, you do have to have a tough skin. I mean, I'm a big reader, as I'm sure you are. I read lots of different things. I'm in a couple of book clubs, and people, you know, that's what book clubs are for. You've got eight people around a table and there'll be complete divergent views a lot of the time, and that's all very healthy. I mean, overall, it's been very positive, and I'm thrilled by that. And people have been often quite intrigued by the subject and surprised and found out stuff they didn't know. They're always asked, why would you want to write about this? Where did that come from? That's such an unusual subject. I've had the did you want to be a priest question quite a few times. If I had, you know, £20 for every time, I'd you know, be quite well off. It's really interesting, because some people, I have a friend who grew up in a Catholic, sort of Catholic background, and I said, what did you think about the religious stuff? And she said, oh, I barely noticed it. And other people, it's all about the religious stuff. So that's the thing. Some people thought they thought it was quite light and funny and comic. Other people thought it was quite intense. I mean, what I was trying to do was a bit of both, actually, because I was trying to capture the experience in the round and have the funny parts, have the comic tone, but also she wants to be a priest, so there's more profound soul-searching stuff in there. It's completely subjective. You write what you want to write. I'm very happy with what I wrote and I'm very happy with the reaction and I'm looking forward to getting stuck into another one very soon. You can't completely lose your sort of sensitive nerve endings or you wouldn't be able to write. But equally, you have to kind of just roll with it really and see what happens.
Talking about the young portrayal of women here, have you had reactions from younger women who have said, actually, I want to go into the clergy because of your book?
No. I shouldn't think you were expecting a different answer.
No, I wasn't.
No, I haven't. I haven't. I haven't put a sort of, you know, for further information, please contact. No, I haven't had any T-shirts made saying, you know, geezer job. But actually, I probably should have done that. I think people been intrigued by it. Yeah, so some people would have a stereotype in their heads of what a woman priest might be like. They would think older woman, house full of cats, sort of bobbly jumpers.
But I like those stereo women.
Yeah, well,
as well.
Absolutely. And they have a place. And of course, there will be women in the church like that. But there are also women who like wearing 8-inch heels and clubbing and partying with their friends and everything that my daughters and your daughters.
I get the impression that it might just change the way men actually approach the clergy as well, that they don't have to be the way that they have been and they would get some LGBT as well.
Of course, there are a lot of them. I think that's right. I think ultimately you want human beings in these roles. It's an ancient post, if you like. I mean, you know, being a priest, I mean, you know, people have been doing it for thousands of years, effectively. But you want people who are going to be authentic in themselves. And I think that's what young women particularly bring to it.
Obviously, Louise, this is your first book and you've had lots and lots of support. But I guess you've had support from your publishers too, have you not?
Oh, I've struck gold with my publishers. So Muswell Press, owned by two sisters, Sarah and Kate Beale, absolutely extraordinary. 50 plus years of experience in the industry behind them, from Bloomsbury to One World across the board. Hugely supportive. They've been going, I think, 2 years now. They're up for an award this year for the best new independent publisher. You couldn't want a better stable to be part of, really. Great fun. Absolutely on the same wavelength, and they're hugely impressive, and I feel very lucky to be part of their gang.
Previous to this amazing book, you are a writer, keynote speech writer. You've done an enormous amount of stuff. You are a Cambridge alumni, and you have also a master's
in novel writing.
This is your passion. You love words, don't you?
I do. I do love words. Yeah, I'm a word person. I'm not really a numbers person, but I am a word person. And I enjoy speech writing because I like writing things that people will actually say. I've always enjoyed that, and I like the sort of freedom of that. But also copywriting. Most recently, I had a stint in working for KPMG in London on their Brexit team, working in the digital marketing department. I was there for 18 months and now freelance for them regularly. I had an absolute ball working there. It was really fun. Fascinating subject, of course, very, you know, hard work, but really interesting. Just the experience of going back into corporate world after having been freelance for a long time was really enormously satisfying for me.
You were a speech keynote writer, and I'm always fascinated by writers in the sense that you're given a subject to write about. Do you put your own side to it, or is it something that is, you have a certain sort of schedule that you have to stick to?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I mean, if you're doing business writing, most of my speech writing experience is there. I think obviously there's an agenda and points and so on that you need to get across. But the most important thing is to capture the personality of the speaker. And
is that hard?
No, because if you're writing somebody a lot, you get to know them and you get to know...
You mean all their foibles?
All their foibles and verbal tics, but also actually a bit of their own story.
Right.
Yeah, because the thing is, you know, you've always got to think, what are the audience... Imagine you're sitting in row 3 and you've got half an hour to listen to somebody. What do you want? You don't just want a series of PowerPoint slides. You actually want maybe a couple of jokes. You definitely want a little bit of insight into what makes him or her tick. Mm. People can't retain too much detailed information, but they'll retain a story. So it's about writing a narrative. I just actually finished reading a great book on women owning the room by Viv Grossop, the writer who writes for The Guardian and so on. And I have to say, I thought it was a great book. She captured it because for all women... whether or not you're talking to an audience of 100 or an audience of one or two in a room, how you present your points, how you sort of hold yourself. I thought actually she captured it really well. And I mean, again, it underlines the fact that I think women, when they're on their feet, there's an extra layer of judgment, actually.
That's interesting.
Just what they're wearing, you know, what they sound like, what their voice is like. I just think it's the same with women on television, you know, news present, Emily Maitlis, whoever. I think there's an extra level, what they're wearing, how they're presenting themselves.
Do you think, is it women that have to work it, or do you think men work it and we don't see this?
Well, I think women have more, actually, funnily enough, I think women have more freedom in this respect, because people are looking at the way they look and what they're wearing and how they sound. You just are. People do look, because men typically will look the same. They are going to be wearing some variation of a suit or jacket and whatever, whereas women, there is more room for movement with colour and styles and so on. And actually, that's a good thing. That's a positive. Women, actually, this is an area where we have a little bit of a head start.
Mm. Just going back to your book, do you find some of the women clergy, the women priests, did they have that sense of imposter syndrome?
Yeah, 100%. That's the ultimate imposter syndrome, really, because it was such a closed world. And I mean, you think about it, everything is geared to men and to, or historically, everything. The entire environment and culture of the church was about men standing there.
So it's total respect, isn't it, for women in the clergy at the moment?
Huge respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, they get also, some people I spoke to get angry. One woman had been spat at in the street. I mean, people do, I mean, it's the same as politicians getting the stuff on Twitter that they get. I think you do have to be brave.
Well, it's been fantastic talking to you, Louise Rowland.
And thank you very much for having me. I've loved it. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
That was Louise Rowland, author of The Girl's Book of Priesthood, talking to Susie Thorpe. That's all we've time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Cassandra Farren, Louise Rowland, and Hilary Cox Condron. We'd also like to thank our contributor this week, Bobby Jones.
If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her. You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.